Stay tuned for The Cinema Clash, as Maryland-based critics Charlie Jewell and Hannah Buchdahl debate the merits of new releases, from the mainstream movies that Hannah tends to favor to obscure foreign films that Charlie likes to champion. It's free-flowing, unedited conversation with an occasional wine wager. Two very different perspectives, one entertaining podcast. Let the clash begin.
Hello and welcome to another Quarantine edition of The Cinema Clash. I am Hannah Buchdahl of ChickFlix.net, joined remotely yet again by my oh-so-friendly co-host, Charlie Jewell of CharlieJewell.com. Do you get the connection there, Charlie?
Hannah, I will never, ever grow tired of your setups. I love your little setups, and I'm pretty sure the friendly, everyone knows I'm not friendly, so friendly must pertain to a film that you saw that I didn't see called Our Friend. Our Friend being the film this week, probably with the biggest star power. It has some actors I actually haven't seen in films in a while, including one who I think has been serving his sentence for some shenanigans who maybe we can bring up later on. But it was one of those virtual premieres. You know, remember back in the day, pre-COVID, you know, we'd get an email, 7 o'clock Tuesday night, go to this movie theater and you'll all go see whatever movie it is. Now you can get an email that's saying, we're doing a virtual premiere Sunday night, 7 o'clock, log on and we'll show you all this movie at the same time, instead of just sending out a screening link. Well, those of us who have children know that 7 p.m. is not a conducive time to watch cinema. Therefore, you saw it, I didn't, and I just can't wait to hear your review.
Yeah, it was interesting. It was fun to just kind of have a timed virtual premiere again with a little Q&A afterwards. But I guess we should probably start with the one that we both saw.
The reason I want to start with The White Tiger is because not only do I actually think it will be the biggest film of the week, because all you need is a Netflix subscription. Our Friend, you actually go out and have to pay $20 to go see. But I remember when I was younger, when HBO was like a big deal. If you had HBO, you were a big deal, and they had the Saturday night movie. It was like, you know, it hasn't been in circulation yet. It'll be, you know, this is the new Batman or whatever on Saturday night. Now Netflix appears to, every Friday they're going to have this new wide release. I think it's going to be kind of an event thing every Friday. Ooh, what's the new Netflix big release? And this week, the big release from Netflix is The White Tiger. Perhaps you've heard of it because it won the Booker Prize way back in 2008. I remember hearing about that because I pay attention to the Booker Prize, but I didn't go and read it. Because it was very, you know, it swept the intelligentsia, you know, ooh, The White Tiger, because it was about globalization and India and outsourcing, you know, buzzwords that a certain people that we hang out with like. Winning the book prize is a big deal. And so I'm very surprised it took 13 years to actually get adapted and hit the screen. That's way too long. I'm surprised that happened. It's got some heavy hitters in the executive producer category. Priyanka Chopra Jonas. She was in the tabloids last year. Jonas, perhaps you've heard of that name. And director Ava DuVernay. You know Ava DuVernay. She's also an executive producer. But we're here to watch Balram. Balram, little Balram, played by Adarsh Gurav. He narrates this. This is his autobiography. And it's like an epic, but it's also this, got this black comedy in it. And he's going to tell you about his story from dirt, poor villager to his version of successful entrepreneur in modern day India. He's an anti-hero, I guess, because he does some stuff that is not morally righteous, but nobody in this story is moral, especially people who have money, and the people who don't have money aren't moral either. I don't know if he's, you know, skewering India as a country because of that, but that's just what he sees. He's got to be cunning. He's got to be ambitious if he wants to improve his station in life. He becomes the second driver to the local landlord family of his rural village, and he watches them, and he schemes, and he's a faithful servant. And a lot of this is about relationship, about the relations between the servants in India and the masters. And he is a very good, for a long time at least, a very good servant. They can hit him, they can smack him, they can push him, they can do whatever they want to him. He will do it, and he will keep a smile on his face because he has been trained to be a servant. There's a big allusion, a big metaphor to roosters. You know, if the roosters see the slaughter, they don't run, they don't fight back, they just wait for it to be their turn. He says, you know what, that's how servants are in India. So you can tell this is adapted from a novel. It feels very long. It's actually only 5 minutes more than 2 hours. It's 2 hours and 5 minutes, so technically a standard movie length. But good Lord, did this feel a lot longer, Hannah.
It felt a lot longer than that to me, especially in the middle. The middle just dragged.
So what did you think of Little Balaram?
Well, you know, the main reason that I was kind of curious to watch it is the writer, screenwriter and director of this is actually Raman Barani, who did 99 Homes in 2014. And I love that movie. That was, you know, similar in terms of talking about societal ills and corruption in politics and society. So there was that sort of parallel there. But this to me was no 99 Homes. I was just bored through much of that narration, you know, because he is narrating his own story. And it just never really took off for me. And I just did not. It's not that I didn't hate it. I just didn't particularly like it. And I think it's going to be a very hard Netflix movie for people to just kind of really settle in and watch all the way through. You can't really multitask because there's a lot of times where there's subtitles on the screen where you have to read what they're saying in English. And so I'm not sure this will really be a good choice for the Netflix viewer. I don't know. We'll see. But, you know, it's to me, it just, I didn't like the guy. And when you really have no, you know, you talked about him being an anti-hero, but when you have nobody to really truly root for in a film, to me, it's, that's critical to my enjoyment sometimes of a movie, unless you've got a really, really powerful story. And so here, I just didn't feel it.
Well, it's not family friendly. You're not going to gather the mom and dad and the kids around the television to watch this. This is for 20-somethings and 30-somethings. I think the people that are still on their professional ascent, and this is another guy maybe they can watch who is also on his professional and personal ascent. You mentioned Ramin Barani. And I mean, it fits in his wheelhouse. Even though it's not as good as 99 Homes, but the commonality is these are both hyper real. This is kitchen sink realism, very stark. He did 99 Homes. He did Man Push Cart. He did Chop Shop. You know, that's stuff where if you maintain your principles and you're the good guy, you're going to get left on the sidelines and maybe killed. You know, if you want to swim with the sharks, you might live and make a little bit of money. You know, you won't be a nice guy, but you will survive in the housing market of 2008. You will survive in New Delhi, you know, living in the garage of a hotel. Did you notice the cliche at the beginning? And that's really starting to get on my nerves. It picks up it starts halfway through the film, and it's like an action scene. They're flying down roads in this car. Music is blasting. People are drunk. They're having a good time. And then freeze frame. But let me start at the beginning. Like, oh God, I hate it when that happens. Like, it's no longer original. Filmmakers out there, it's no longer, we've seen this 19,000 times. Stop doing this. It's not cute anymore.
Yeah. I mean, it definitely makes you think, oh my gosh, is the caste system? Is that still around? Is this still the way it goes? How does this compare to Slumdog Millionaire? And I think people are going to kind of automatically draw that comparison a little bit. And this is not Slumdog Millionaire. It's a different side of that same story, perhaps, but not done in nearly as entertaining of a way, which is why it's not the family-friendly kind of film that I think Slumdog Millionaire was more so than this. But yeah, you just kind of go, boy, that the whole American outsourcing to India of things, it's got some interesting themes going. But again, because I did not particularly like where the main character's moral compass ultimately landed, I could not get behind him.
This makes Slumdog Millionaire look like La La Land. I think he doesn't mention it by name, but he calls out Slumdog Millionaire in the movie and during his narrations. Like, I know you're thinking this is going to be some kind of blah, blah, blah. And that blah, 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 he's actually mentioning the storyline of Slumdog. Mm-hmm. There's no way around it. You have to mention it because they're just too similar. And I know, you know, that just as many films come out of Bollywood as come out of Hollywood. So there's no reason these two should be, you know, juxtaposed side by side. But, you know, only a select few films about India permeate our American market. So there's nothing, it's not against The White Tiger or Slumdog. They're just going to be compared and contrasted with one another. This one's more real than Slumdog. I'll give you that. I guarantee you this is more true to life than Slumdog.
But not, again, not as good a watch for, I think, the larger audience. So I don't know. I don't know if by trying to promote it as a Netflix special screening opportunity on Saturday night, it is going to capture people, unless they think, you know, unless you get a few leftover people who don't realize that that Tiger King was over.
Well, a large chunk of our audience reads books. So Christian, Joellen, Eileen, if you have read The White Tiger, you know, drop us a line, let us know, say, I check this out on Netflix. Does it hold water, or did they just butcher it? Or maybe the book was that boring too. I don't think it was, because, you know, enough people were talking about it, but. You know,
absolutely. I would be most interested, I think, in finding out who read the book and how this measures up to what they envisioned while they were reading. And that's always the way. And so I think this is probably going to be a film that really is for the literary folks, and the ones who actually read the book, they might have, I think, a greater interest in seeing how it plays out.
And I think it depends on how you look at the protagonist. You didn't like him, but, and I know why, he does something. But honestly, if he didn't do that thing, and I'm not saying he did it right, if he did a bad thing, but if he didn't do it, you know, what would his life look like? And it's not like, you know, no one's innocent in this film. Nobody's innocent. I didn't judge him as harshly as you did.
Well, I judge him harshly because it was a pretty harsh thing. So it will be, yes, to each his own, I suppose. So we'll have to wait and see and get some additional feedback from anyone who's actually watched it and read the book. So we'll see. And again, we'll see what the numbers are when those Netflix premiere numbers come out.
All right. Well, tell me about, I don't even know the giant, it looks like a weeper technically, but tell me about technically who's in Our Friend, and is it a lighter watch than The White Tiger?
A lighter watch about someone dying from cancer. I mean, really, what could go wrong? You talk about reading. Well, this is for people who might have read this 2015 Esquire article on which this film is based. And it's a true story. And the writer was of the article was Matthew Teague. He's a journalist. He wrote this essay about the slow and painful death of his wife, Nicole. She died of ovarian cancer at 36. But then the article really wasn't just about him and his wife and their ordeal. It ultimately was about their best friend, this guy named Dane, who put his own life in New Orleans totally on hold to go help Nicole and Matthew and their two young girls at their house in Fairhope, Alabama. You know, he became like a caregiver, and it's a story that is, you know, heartbreaking, uplifting all at once. Definitely will have you thinking, you know, who your friends are, what kind of sacrifices they might make in similar situations, the type of friend you would want to be in these types of situations. I mean, this went way beyond a little cooking or babysitting or GoFundMe setup type stuff. Dane was really, he was all in as a friend and as a caregiver extraordinaire. And so when Nicole eventually succumbed to cancer, Teague was really able to just sort of take this step back and see just how critical Dane was to his own survival. So I call it really the strongest male bonding tearjerker cancer movie with heart since 50-50. Do you remember that one with Seth Rogen and Joseph Gordon-Levitt?
I remember it very well. I loved that movie. In fact, I made my top 10 list that year.
And Mine too.
Before you named Drop 50-50, when you said male bonding cancer movie, I was about to say, oh my God, 50-50.
Exactly. That was what came to mind. I mean, this isn't as good as 50-50, but it's in that sort of category with a little bit of, I would say, with a little bit of Beaches thrown into the mix and Terms of Endearment.
No, you're not helping yourself now. Now you're shooting yourself in the foot.
So, you know, we are talking kind of chick flicks and bromance all together. This was like a friendship triangle that was going on. It has three really, really good performances, and that's what kind of really makes this movie work. Jason Segel from Forgetting Sarah Marshall and most people would know him from How I Met Your Mother on TV. He plays Dane, this friend who some might see, you know, from the outside, he seems kind of like a loser. You know, he's got like a dead end job for years, can't seem to maintain a relationship. But he's always been a friend to Matt and Nicole. And when they needed him most, you know, here he was there. And so Dakota Johnson plays Nicole. And then Casey Affleck, Academy Award winner for Manchester by the Sea, he plays Matthew Teague. And so you just have three, sorry, the cat is now right in front of me. You just have three very, very good performances.
And, well, the one I want to ask about, because we haven't seen him in a while, is Casey Affleck. Casey Affleck got in trouble. Hashtag me too. Some stories emerged about him, and he was cancel cultured. He was removed. And this is kind of the first time I've seen him back in a while. Is he back, or was it filmed a long time ago?
Oh, I don't know that, but I mean, he's certainly back. I think it's that same kind of general character that we saw in Manchester by the Sea. So it's in his wheelhouse.
You mean sad sack of a human?
Yeah, just sort of sad. You know, he's got a lot of sad stuff going on, but Dakota Johnson, you know, I really liked her. She was just recently in the Peanut Butter Falcon. So whereas she is 50 Shades franchise queen, in this movie, she really just also plays to her strengths and is very good. And I didn't like the construction of the narrative of this. It's really hard to write a full-blown screenplay off of a magazine article. And when the two of the three protagonists are still very much around and alive. And so this was definitely done with Matthew Teague's full involvement and cooperation. I got the sense from the Q&A after the movie that the real Dane is not necessarily like out there plugging his portrayal in this movie. So, you know, you got to sort of understand that with all these true stories, there's going to be just a little bit of, you know, iffiness out there about what's real and what was done for creative license purposes. The article was called "The Friend, Love is Not a Big Enough Word." And I highly encourage people to really read the article first. And it really helps kind of set, I think, the stage for this movie. The movie itself, even it's rated R, but it is a far more sanitized version of sort of Nicole's death and everything that she went through, and some really just really dehumanizing effects of her cancer. And so the article, you know, I would have thought if they really stayed true to the article, they might have been showing a lot more of the just the rough stuff that they all had to go through watching her kind of slowly disappear. But it's just a tearjerker. It's one where you will need your hankies. And I really don't. It's not a hard R at all. I would say it's a very soft R, and it could have been. It could have been a much tougher watch. It's not a tough watch. It's a sort of heartbreaking and heartwarming watch all at the same time. And so, you know, that's, I think, going to appeal to a lot of people. And especially, you know, right now when people talk about isolation and friendship and what that means, I think, ironically, this could be the right kind of time to really talk about a movie and themes like this.
Well, you got me thinking about films based on magazine articles, and two spring to mind. From last year, Hustlers with Jennifer Lopez, we just saw at the inauguration, and War Dogs with Jonah Hill and Miles Teller when they were gun running. I think films can work just fine off of magazine articles, but yeah, you need a good screenwriter to make that happen.
Yeah, and this was challenging, although it is the same screenwriter who, Brad Inglesby, who wrote The Way Back, which ironically stars the other Affleck, Ben, in a movie that just recently came out.
Yeah, there's a lot of buzz about Ben. I don't think he's going to get any noms for that, but there's still buzz about it.
Yeah.
All right.
Brothers are good.
Remember two weeks ago, we watched Liam Neeson play his same Liam Neeson character in The Marksman, and it was kind of about the U.S.-Mexican border for a little bit, at least in the first 20 minutes. Well, I watched a film this week called Identifying Features, which is really about the U.S.-Mexican border. This is a real film about that, not a garbage pile like The Marksman. We have Magdalena, played by Mercedes Hernandez. She has lost contact with her son after he took off with a friend from their small town in southern Mexico, and they went to go cross the border into Arizona and hopefully find work. And he's disappeared. You know, it's been a few weeks now, and she hasn't heard anything. This is not like, you know, it's not like him. He was going to check in. So she's desperate to find out what happened to him. So she goes north looking. She doesn't know if he's dead. She doesn't know if he's alive. And it's a very dangerous journey. This is cartel territory. The indiscriminate violence is just obscene. It's absurd what's going on up there. And she's on a journey to discover the truth. At the same time, a young man named Miguel, he is returning to Mexico after being deported from the United States. You're watching his path of deportation. And eventually their paths converge. They start traveling together and they form this, you know, this sort of mother-son bond. Miguel's a bit more realistic. He doesn't know what happened, but he's got a clue. Identifying Features won the Audience Award, the World Dramatic Competition at 2020 Sundance Film Festival. It also won the Best Screenplay Award, same category at the Sundance Film Festival. It's a heavy watch. I'm not saying this ends on a happy note, but I loved actually the directorial choices. Directed by Fernanda Valadez. There's a towards the end, there's a flashback where we're seeing something happened. And there's an old man telling it. And he's not speaking English. He's not speaking Spanish. He's speaking some indigenous dialect. And there's no subtitles. The director consciously chose no subtitles. We don't technically know what he's saying, but we're watching it. We know exactly what's happening. And I loved watching this scene without reading anything, any dialogue about it, because everybody, the entire audience, we're watching it. We know what happened. We don't need to read his words. And that's just a brilliant idea. You don't see that too often. I loved the editing. It didn't switch back and forth between Magdalena and people speaking to her. You know, she goes to the first police station and they show her the book. These are the pictures of the dead bodies we have found in the past 2 weeks. And we don't actually see the officer saying this. We're watching Magdalena's face. And every time someone comes up to her and says something, or someone whispers to her, like, hey, you're asking questions too loud here. You're putting a target on your back. We don't see who's saying it. We only see Magdalena. And I really think that's just a brilliant move. You know, this is not a vigilante film. Magdalena's not packing guns and seeking revenge here. She's just walking. She's walking. She's talking. She's saying, hey, my son might have come this way. Do you remember him? And she's just charting her own path. It's a wonderful film. It's in my top five foreign films of the year, international films of the year. It's got weight. It's got punch. This is a film to watch.
And where can people watch that one?
Oh, probably the same place you can watch Our Friend for a couple of bucks on the video on demand sites. It's from Kino Lorber. So, you know, they're the art house guys. So this is, you know, standard video on demand places.
Yeah, no, it definitely sounds like art house film to me. So I think I went a lot more mainstream with Our Friend, and you went, you know, traditionally.
I did what we do.
Art house. You did what we do. And I must confess, I was really watching much more inauguration stuff this week than movies, and that's why I kind of dropped the ball on catching anything else beyond The White Tiger and Our Friend, because there was just too much else going on, Charlie.
I know. I watched a lot of television on Inauguration Day. And then when I drove to work on Thursday morning, I expected most of that National Guard to be gone, and they weren't. And it took me forever to get to work because D.C. was still locked down. And getting through D.C. when it's locked down is not an easy thing to do when there's Humvees all over the place.
Well, and I got to tell you, those fireworks must have been unbelievable all the way in downtown DC, because I actually could see them from my balcony. Not much, but between the buildings, I could see those fireworks. And we're talking, what are we, about 15 to 20 miles north of the Capitol? So So it must have been quite an impressive feat to actually be down there and see those fireworks.
That was a good program to watch. Your boy Springsteen was on there.
I know. Gotta love Springsteen. So I will do a plug that, you know, if you didn't get enough of your Springsteen, you can still watch Springsteen's Letter to You on, I think that's Apple TV Plus. I think more people will enjoy that one. That's just an easy, breezy, multitask while you watch kind of movie.
Well, very quickly, I caught up with two more that people are still talking about. I watched Denmark's submission for Best International Film called Another Round with everyone's favorite Mads Mikkelsen. Mm-hmm. A lot of critics like it more than I do. it's not terrible, but it's about alcoholism, and it's half funny and it's half not funny.
And I do know that somebody who loves Mads Mikkelsen enjoyed the movie. And so if you're a Mads fan, apparently there's a dance scene near the end that actually makes up for whatever shortcomings the movie might have had.
It's the best scene in the film. It's worth it's worth sitting through the film just to get to that scene, because it's one of the best endings of the year. It's just not one of the best movies of the year.
Well, and I found it on YouTube, so I was like, really, do I need to see anything beyond the dance scene at the end?
Well, it's not earned. I mean, it's nice to watch it, but you won't feel it, Hannah. You won't feel it. Gotcha. You don't know what it means.
All right.
But, and then I finally got around to Tenet. You know, Christopher Nolan's Tenet that was supposed to break box office records and blow up IMAX, that, you know, it went to theaters and not too many people went to see it because we weren't going to movie theaters at that time. Well, I finally caught up with it, watched it on Blu-ray, and man, I'm not smart enough for that movie. I need to watch some videos that called like Tenet Explained. It is really challenging. It's riveting. You know, I was glued to my chair, but man, a lot of it I just didn't get. It's very loud. I need to. A lot of people say, and I agree with them. I need to watch it with closed captioning. I need to watch it with subtitles because the dialogue is drowned out. It's too damn loud. It is so loud. You can't hear the people talking. The sound mix is just completely nuts on this thing. So, Tenet might be a little bit of misfire for Mr. Nolan there.
Well, and if it's too heady for you, can you even imagine if I tried to sit through that? So, I think it's good to know that I didn't miss much. Certainly, that I didn't miss anything by grumbling about the fact that we were actually not invited to the in-theater premiere that I would not have gone to anyway, but it would have been nice to be invited. And so now I'm like, well, you know, obviously, it's okay that I missed it. I'm not sure this is one that I would need to catch up on. It had so much buzz.
I think you will end up seeing it because for whatever reason, and I don't think it deserves it, it's going to get nominated for Tech Awards.
Okay.
Visual effects, hopefully not sound because it's atrocious, but who knows? It might slip in there for cinematography or editing just because it looks pretty at points. People are going to throw some noms its way, and this thing, you know, might rack up two or three Oscar noms, and that means it's on your plate, Hannah.
Yeah, all right. Well, I don't care if it racks up the noms as long as it doesn't just automatically rack up the wins. But I'll if I have to put it on my list, we have a little bit of time before the Academy Awards, thank goodness. I think mid-April, so early April. So I have some time to decide whether it's worth catching up on something like Tenet. How long is it? Like 2.5 hours?
Two and change. It felt shorter than The White Tiger.
Oh, okay. There you go.
I don't think it is shorter than The White Tiger, but it felt shorter.
Well, and one of the ones that I meant to mention last week, I don't think I did, so just in case, Promising Young Woman, which we talked about a couple weeks ago, is now available on demand. I think you have to pay the $20 for it, but it's worth it. If you're going to pay for any movie right now, I would say Promising Young Woman is the one to pay for to really understand when you talk about something that should be nominated for stuff. That one should definitely be at the top of everyone's list.
Yeah, I'm with you. If I had $20 burning a hole in my pocket and I really just wanted to watch a movie and really pay for it, that's the one to do it.
Yep.
Speaking of movies you have to pay for, and another one that we're going to circle back to from a couple weeks ago is The Dissident, the documentary The Dissident, remember from Brian Fogler that Netflix didn't pick up or Amazon or any of those people because they were afraid of Saudi Arabia. Well, Fogler's point was proven. Last week, a couple thousand negative one-star reviews were dumped on The Dissident, on IMDb, on Rotten Tomatoes, like all at the same time. And, you know, Fogler talked about the army of internet trolls, the flies that work for Mohammed bin Salman, that, you know, make sure to trend any good news and squash any bad news. Well, the dissident is bad news. You know, it's about Mohammed bin Salman planning and being complicit in the murder of Jamal Khashoggi. So, you know, they just throttled the audience scores online for this film, and it's so blatant. Like, they didn't do a very good job of spacing it out, of not plagiarizing one another, of writing it in this choppy English that, you know, is machine kind of translated. Yeah, read the, there's an article in today's post by Steven Zeitchik if you want to read about this. But yeah, they're proving the film's point. They're you know, this films like this rely on fresh tomatoes, on audience scores. People are like, oh, I don't know if I want to watch a documentary. Is it any good? And it had a fresh tomato. It had very strong reviews. Critics liked The Dissident. But now, you know, the algorithms are catching on to what's going on. But the Dissident is now suffering in audience scores due to Saudi internet trolls.
Wow, that sort of reminds me of Social Dilemma and what that movie, what that documentary was trying to warn us about. And so it's the kind of thing where you go, maybe more people should watch The Dissident, if only to counteract the trolls, because I do think it deserves a fresh tomato. It wasn't my favorite documentary of the year. I think it may be in my top 10, not my top 5, but you know, to see just the injustice and what was obviously this premeditated murder of this journalist. You know, it's the guy, he deserves to get justice, and I'm not sure that that he's really gotten it. And so the Saudis, I think at this point, might just be kind of shooting themselves in the foot by trying to squash this documentary.
You know, this is just another reminder to all the autocrats out there, all the dictators. If they had left this alone, it would have already gone away. Nobody mm-hmm. was really talking about The Dissident anymore. It had arrived. People rated it. People talked about it. They wrote their articles, and they had moved on. And you waited this long to do what you did, and now it's back in the news cycle. Way to go.
Yep. So it just goes to show you that, you know, timing is everything.
You should have done it on the day of release.
Should have done it weeks and weeks and weeks ago. And it's been out in the ether for quite a while now. And so, yes, you're right. It would have just sort of gone away quietly. And now I feel like championing the movie a little bit more than I would have otherwise.
And the circle's coming around again. Remember Jeff Bezos, the owner of the Post, and who's featured heavily in the film because of, you know, he got squashed a little bit by Mohammed bin Salman. I learned today that Amazon owns IMDb.
So, I didn't know
that. Yeah, it's you know, their algorithm needs to catch this because, you know, it's Bezos's website, IMDb. I had no idea.
Algorithms, gotta love them. Mm-hmm. Anyway, all right. Well, I think that will do it. That's a good point to wrap out on. For this edition of the Cinema Clash, our very first under the new Biden-Harris administration. Thanks so much for listening. As always, if you have a question, comment, or just need to vent to Charlie, shoot us a tweet or visit us at thecinemaclash.com. Till next time, wear a mask, watch your distance, wash those hands, and when it's your turn, please take the shot.
Take the shot.
The Cinema Clash with Charlie Jewell and Hannah Buchdahl is heard twice each weekend at 5:15 on Saturday and 12:15 on Sunday afternoon. Join us again next time for The Cinema Clash.